Welcome to Happy Times and Places, a positively inclined Doctor Who episode commentary podcast in which that git who appears on all of the Doctor Who Blu-rays tries to see if he can guess what his special guest's favourite things about a nominated episode of Doctor Who might be.
Hi, I'm Ruben. I'm a Doctor Who fan. I'm picking The Green Death. It's the beginning of the end of the UNIT family era and such a sweet goodbye to Joe Grant.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to this edition of Happy Times and Places, which is going to take us into episode 2 of The Green Death. Late Pertwee, just before all change. I never consider season 11 kind of what I imagined Pertwee, because I always considered Sarah Jane a Tom Baker companion, because that's, you know, those were the books I read, and that's what I understood from various magazine articles I read or whatever, and it was relatively late in my discovery of, you know, the basics of Doctor Who that I realised Sarah was actually part of the Pertwee era. So associated was she for me with Tom Baker. So I always considered, you know, sort of subconsciously, season 11 a bit of an anomaly, and also I suppose because I was going to say the unit's not in it much, but actually it's in it a decent amount. But anyway, this is of course, you know, the last great flourishing, really, especially with the Master gone and now Joe Grant on our way out as well. It feels like, you know, the unit era is being wound down. It very much is the end of an era, particularly with the departure of Joe Grant. Forgive if it sounded like I was making lots of noises there. I'm trying to get comfortable. I'm trying to work out a way of recording this. You know, I've got terrible posture, you know. So, but if I lean back, I'll be too far away from the microphone. Anyway, you don't need to know about the ballast required for me to broadcast correctly. But some people say they like this, if I sort of explain, you know, if I break the fourth wall and give you a little glimpse behind the scenes. I'm not sure myself. Anyway, that's enough of it. Let's make it a brief sojourn into the back room, and let's get the proper content front and centre as we press play on episode 2 of The Green Death. Our guide will be Ruben Herfindahl, my friend, one of those friends I've never met, from across the pond, who will... His introduction, you know, sounded not unlike, you know, his experience of being a Doctor Who fan was not unlike my own, even though, you know, our backgrounds, the order in which we're exposed to Who... you know, the stories we will have watched, how we will have digested them, all completely different. But nonetheless, Doctor Whonomism is a universal language. So let's press play on episode 2 of The Green Death in 3, 2, 1. Oh, and of course, this is the last story to have this gorgeous title sequence. I think it's slightly underrated, even by me, this title sequence, because I think it is superseded by the first Tom Baker one, and because the William Hartnell one is just such an abstract piece of genius in it, but yet its simplicity. But I think this Pertwee one, which is, you know, does everything it needs to do, and it's just some sort of whirly shapes, but it's perfectly rendered, and the colours are great, and it sort of reminds me of this, you know, this good quality version of it reminds me of sitting in front of a log fire. Watching it, so it warms my cheeks as I watch it. So here we go. Telfer and Thomas. I knew him as a dead actor before I even sort of watched him in stuff, really, because he'd been a friend of mine had told me about Survivors and said that he'd played a bad guy in it, but that he was, you know, he was already dead. So now this is that's the bad CSO that worried me so. Then, you know, bad CSO was a terrible thing. Oh, that I've just noticed that the set recedes into the background there, but rather simply effectively done with a photo. This is, yeah, that's a photo giving a bit of perspective backdrop to the set. This is very well done with the sparks and everything. This feels real. This real sweat on Telfer and Thomas there. This is the sort of thing that could seem a little clunky, or might not seem as metallic as it needs to. But yeah, no, he's got proper sweat on him, hasn't he? Telf the Teeth, as he was known. He was definitely the BBC's resident Welshman, but he's excellent. And a bit of a legend because of Dad's Army, and he's excellent in Survivors too. But yes, he was Private Cheeseman in Dad's Army, who was a sort of short-lived regular. After, I think, was it Private Walker? James Beck had died. They sort of brought him, but he didn't last long. Apparently, John Laurie, who played Fraser, said, he's got to go, because he was doomed. He was doomed by muscling in on his co-star's turf, I think. I don't know. So Roy Evans, I mean, gosh, I remember seeing him crop up on a McDonald's advert. I think a McDonald's advert. I was going to say recently, but it'll probably be 15, 20 years ago. But we tried to get him for the commentary for this, but apparently his partner didn't like the contract, I think was what was said. Anyway, dropped out for a sort of strange, arbitrary reason. He is on the original Green Death. We did a commentary for the special edition. So he was involved in Paul Venezis's, Man Alive spoof with Mark Gatiss, and Paul did interview him then and said he was great fun. But I've never had the pleasure. I have exchanged letters with him a couple of times, and he seems absolute fun. But he didn't want to do an interview because he said he'd just turned 90, just moved to house, his partner had just passed away, and he was just, he said, "It's age, dear." Bless him. But then he sent me a lovely letter about Lenny Mayne, about them smoking and shagging, as he put it. So good for him. So he's in his 90s, Roy. Still going. Good for him. There's just something very natural about Telfer and Thomas. He's got all the business. He knows exactly how to do it. And what a brilliant face. You don't get teeth like that really anymore. But it's great because he's a character actor who plays all sorts of different characters, and yet you always know it's that actor because he's so distinctive. It's sort of contradictory in that he plays all sorts of different parts and pops up in everything, and yet everybody kind of knows it's that guy. I think we did that with actors in those days, and I there was something fun to be had by, spotting an actor you knew doing different things. That Green Death effect is superb. I mean, that's it's marvellous that they've discovered that they can do this effect and that they sort of basically draw a story around it. I'm not sure that was the way around, but it must have been in their minds. How do we do this? How what can we do this with this effect that we've got? Well, we could make somebody glow. And of course the title, The Green Death, it is a green story. It is an eco story. Now it's just obviously because it looks cool, because it's green, but, Is it that they're sending a message through the story title that it is a green story, or is that just a happy coincidence? Because I don't think it was by this time called the Green Party, because it was called the Ecology Party, everybody. And it was, I believe, at a meeting of the Ecology Party that an actor who was active in the Ecology Party suggested it change its name in line with its European counterparts, which were all called green, or that language is equivalent of green. And the actor that suggested that was John Abernethy, who was General Carrington, the Ambassadors of Death, and Railton in Death to the Daleks, and Rankwin. He's green. Ha ha! Yes, see, he had an agenda. That's why the swamp is a green. It's the actor putting his political views across through the medium of skin pigmentation. Oh, BBC has been invaded by the eco-terrorists. He's also Van Lutyens in Fury from the Deep. I love the way that Ben Howard sort of very casually bats John Rolfe back here, and he's smoking a fag, one of the rare cigarettes in Doctor Who. There's quite a few cigarettes in this, and I think this is lovely how Stevens resists or is regretful about what they're going to do to John Rolfe's character here. It's Fel, isn't it? I think he's Bell in the book, or the other way around. And of course, Fel, yeah, he is. He's Fel. which is nominative determinism, because that's how he meets his end by falling from a window. But I will tell you about John Rolfe as well. John Rolfe and Jerome Willis Stevens have a slight connection to me and my first exposure with actors and the world of acting. But yeah, it's an eco story, and that, you know, it's very much, you know, what the Pertwee era sort of thinks about. But you know, even with Colony and Space, when it's projecting our future and the mutants, you know, it paints an Earth that is spacefaring because we've gutted our planet and left it knackered. And as I record this, you know, we have a government that is allowing water companies to pollute our seas and our waters because short-term money is more important than long-term health of the planet. And you know, I'm not a glue myself to the pavement kind of guy, but you know, I was saying I do what I can to Katie Manning, who is hugely on message with this even now, and does more than her bit. And I said, you know, I do what I can, and she said, and bless her, because that's a very middle class me thing of, you know, it's, there's a lot of people like me who sort of pat ourselves on the back because we go, well, you know, we recycle, and I buy Ecova washing up liquid. I'm doing what I can. And Katie is actually pretty hardline. He goes, well, actually, what you can is not enough. We need to do more. And so I do admire people like Katie more than I admire people like me, because, you know, I am probably eco to my convenience. But by the same token, you know, I do think those who stop the traffic and stop people getting to their hospital appointments or even their holidays, that to me is not how you win the country over. But you know, if it is as urgent as is reported, perhaps we do need to wake up, and my very middle class way of doing it is not enough. And so, you know, I think it's great that a Doctor Who story will, you know, raise these issues, and the Doctor was doing it, you know, 40 years ago. I mean, incredible. Well done, Doctor Who. And you know, it puts a lie to that idea that only recent Doctor Who has had any form of an agenda, and that somehow, you know, it's been taken over by the Wokarati. You know, these people were up at dawn recycling their newspapers. So, but the most important thing is that this doesn't feel especially didactic. I think it's all worked into the story rather artfully, and the fact that the Quorn sausages are the way of defeating the industrial waste is neat and thematic, but it all makes sense within the story, you know. Marks for Pertwee's costume, by the way. I think he looks great in this, and as there's loads of publicity photographs that are very familiar to me of this story, of everyone on location. So the costumes and you know, Pertwee and Cliff Jones and what Joe's wearing and everything all seem, you know, very familiar and comfortable. I have to say from the book, I thought the miners would be sort of a bit tougher and grittier. I remember being quite surprised by sort of John Scott Martin's performance in episode one, which is, slightly comical in a way that perhaps it wasn't intended to be, but it's always nice to see John Scott Martin, and he, you know, he's very high pitched, isn't he, Roy Evans? He's very I'm very falsetto. He's like a falsetto miner, but of course no reason why they shouldn't be, but I just expected them to be gruffer and tougher, and of course mining was very much you know, has always been very much at the forefront of industrial relations in Great Britain. So it's all there in the mix as a backdrop, and a rather interesting backdrop, I think, to a Doctor Who story that is about more than just, you know, scaring the kiddies. I always like it when John Pertwee's Doctor, because he's so mean to people, it could be such an arse. When he, you know, genuinely says to somebody, I want to shake your hand and I think you're pretty good, you always go, well, God, this is serious business then. This must be all right. I like the fact that Dave sort of goes to help. That's rather nice, because he's just, you know, they've got a really good actor for what is essentially quite a, you know, supporting role there, Telford and Thomas. Oh, Terry Walsh here is the guard. Oh, it's quite like it in Doctor Who, where you can have, factory complexes, basically industrial complexes that have got sort of jackbooted fascist guards. So this is the equivalent of Extinction Rebellion, isn't it? They haven't glued themselves to the pavement. They're doing it through the medium of music and daubed signs. So we've got the so Stephen's out. Okay. So anyway, let me talk to you about Jerome Willis and John Rolfe, because Jerome Willis, so I see, yes, they're playing the music to distract the guards while John Pertwee has a very John Pertwee thing to do. Gets in a whatever it's called, a forklifty thing. It's not that. It's a sort of digger thing. Goes over the barbed wire and in. Beautiful. No messing about. No need for psychic paper. Distraction by hippie. Entrance by forklift. It's not a forklift. If I wasn't having to broadcast, I would know what that was called without even thinking about it, because I'm having to think and talk at the same time. That my brain and my mouth do not connect. So instead, this extemporizing pours out and passes for entertainment. So let's not dwell on it. If I hadn't dwelt on it, you wouldn't have even probably picked up on it. But now that I've drawn attention to it, I've ruined everything. But I have bought us time to get to Jerome Willis as Stephen. So I was surprised he had a moustache, because he doesn't in... I think it's Alan Willow's illustrations in the book of The Green Death. Jerome Willis was in Richard III at the Ludlow Festival, directed by Peter Cregeen, who was the man who actually, was sort of responsible for Doctor Who going away when it did. But he was an excellent theatre director and a very good television director. Directed some Out of the Unknowns. He was behind some of the better years of The Bill. And he was head of BBC Drama at the time when Doctor Who was slowly sort of taken away. But I've met Peter a few times, but the first time I was aware of his name was when my brother, who is a few years old, 4 years older than me, was one of the princes in the tower at the Ludlow Festival. Edward Woodward playing Richard III, directed by Peter Cregeen. And they needed two school kids to play the princes in the tower. And my brother and his friend Bill Fathers auditioned and got it. So my brother was part of a theatrical company, and that scuppered me a bit, because it meant that I had to go and stay at the local boarding school, because my mum had to chaperone my brother. So it meant 2 weeks away, 2 or 3 weeks away from home for me. So it wasn't great for me whilst my brother was doing. But I think that planted the seeds for me a bit of, you could be part of an acting company. My brother had taken photographs and he'd got a signed poster in it, and they all looked after him and were very nice to him. And I sat in on some of the rehearsals. I remember Edward Woodward shouting at, because it was at Ludlow Castle, so it was in the open air. I love this. I'm quite spry for my age. And I love the way Ben Howard goes. You're going to go, oh, terrific. Again, he's not mugging the thuggery. It's a very natural sort of laid back and it's Alan Chuns, and I think the other one's Billy Horrigan, the one with the goatee. The guards, but yeah, it's quite laid back sort of, and it seems to me genuine Cockney thuggery that always brings Doctor Who down to earth a little bit. It's a serial that can have quite overblown villainy. So when it's a sort of Ben Howard, I think, is the sort of character you'd associate more with a Douglas Camfield, where the gritty, earthy working class characters are actually a bit more believable than they might be if they were, presented by somebody whose natural mode is RP and they're thugging it up. Jerome Willis was in Richard III playing a lovely part, playing Clarence at the Ludlow Festival, directed by Peter Cregeen, with Edward Woodward as Richard III, Malfa and Voice of the Rills as the Duke of Buckingham, and an actor called Brian Graspari, who was in The Gentle Touch and quite a few other things, as Hastings, and yeah, the fourth lead really is Clarence, although he gets killed fairly early on. It's a very good part played by Jerome Willis, and Michelle Dutrice, who was Edward Woodward's wife, was playing Lady Anne. No, the other one, Elizabeth. Anyway, shh, stop. This is not what you want to know. You want to know about Jerome Willis. Jerome Willis was lovely, and my brother, and he actually came back to the Ludlow Festival the following year to do Antony and Cleopatra. He played Ian Barbus, which is the best part in it, again directed by Peter Grugin. Antony was Dennis Lill from The Awakening and Image of the Fendal, and Cleopatra was Eleanor Bron from Revelation of the Daleks and City of Death. So you see, I was not from a theatrical background, but the Shakespeare play came to visit for 2 weeks every summer and was played in the open air in the castle and had, you know, proper actors. And I've got all the programmes upstairs going back to before I was born. Some of the early ones were directed by Professor Chronotis, who was also a noted theatre director. So the actors would come to town. So I remember being so excited that my brother, who never didn't go into the business, nor did he particularly want to, but he had such a nice time that it sort of planted the seed for me, really, that such a thing was possible, and such a, you know, and that there were people that did that for a living, and they seemed to have a jolly time, and it was having that in Ludlow that made me feel I could sort of almost touch the business. And why this is relevant to Doctor Who is because Jerome Willis put in his programme notes, you know, his TV credits include, you know, whatever, The Sandbaggers and whatever, I don't know what else, Age of Kings, well, I don't think he was in that, but, you know, this, that, blah, 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 and Doctor Who and the Green Death, in which he played the lead villain. Now, you didn't normally go into such details. It was normally just the names of the programme, you know, as I say, you know, Emergency Ward 10 and The Power Game or whatever, and you just say and Doctor Who, but he specified. I love the fact that for Chris Chapman's documentary on the Blu-ray for the Green Death, they actually found this guy who did the weld, you know, had the cutting gear. I love that because, you know, he gets a close up, he's got a face. You know, if you showed me that capture, I'd go, oh yeah, that's that guy from that bit of the Green Death. Well, they found him and he's around and he's got a story to tell. I love that. Doctor, you know, 40 years later, but Doctor Who touches lives. And, you know, I would recognise him more than I might recognise somebody that I worked with for 3 years in a restaurant, because that's the way it works, isn't it? Yeah, it's this CSO has been improved from how it was when I watched it as a kid, I think. Because it was ghastly, the mine CSO, and as I say, it used to set my blooming teeth on edge. So Jerome Willis, and then I wrote to him subsequently because I did a university thing about different actors, because he'd also been in Ludlow Festival years and years before my brother or I were born, or certainly I was born, in the Scottish play in the 60s, because it had been going on for years, Ludlow Festival, and he played Banquo to the Macduff of Bernard Kay in the Scottish play. And so I wrote to him about the Scottish play, and he wrote me a lovely letter back. So I do have a letter from Jerome Willis, but I didn't ask him about Doctor Who, because this was for a college project, a university project. And so I never got to meet him, but I sort of feel like I have, because I sort of contacted him there. And again, Paul interviewed him for the Green Death Blu-ray, and I think he's excellent in this as Stevens. But I love the fact that he put in his programme that he was the lead villain in Doctor Who and the Green Death. But also in that production of Richard III was John Rolfe, who plays Fel in this. So it was a sort of Green Death reunion. Oh, but don't touch. Now, I think that's very good, but I do love it in Inferno when Walter Randall touches the green slime, and because it's hot, you get a bit of steam coming off it. But obviously, that's a different thing. But, Bert, why did you touch it? Especially as look at Di, who's been dyed green. Oh, dear. So as soon as he's touched that, you know that Bert is on borrowed time. And that's so sad. But it leads to, you know, it leads to a contemplation on the death of supporting characters, which I think is quite an important part of this story. Pertwee's so capable, isn't he? He's even looks cool in a jumpsuit with a miner's helmet on. Oh, yeah, he's a really capable and you know doughty fellow is the Third Doctor. And look at the lighting down this mine; it's all slightly sort of green and fluorescent. And the Green Death is industrial slime, which is, you know, a very important part of the story, that this isn't an alien incursion, this is a man-made, I mean, it could be sort of an episode of Doomwatch, really, but it's in the Doctor Who format, so it's slightly more fantastical. Oh, that's so good. Oh, and the fact that, you know, he's not a soldier in the line, you know, or a policeman, you know, in the line of duty, or he's a miner who was helping an ordinary, you know, it's Doctor Who is the extraordinary impacting on ordinary lives, and it makes people brave, and it makes people scared, and it's dangerous for people. Poor old Bert with his again, it's very simple effect, the glowing green on the fingers is excellent. And this is all quite claustrophobic, isn't it? I mean, these sets are, you know, I mean, they have to be able to stand up, and they can't be as dark as perhaps they would, but I think they're a decent attempt, especially when you've got the torch and the headlamp. And I like the fact that Telfrin Thomas shouts a little bit of Welsh as well, just to make it more believable, and to make it, to make it seem more, it is more authentic that way. But yeah, I think the lighting down here in these caves is magnificent. And the extraordinary smell, you know, it's grim, because, you know, maggot, I don't know if you've ever come across maggots, they are quite stinky. And I lived out in the countryside, so you would quite often, I remember upturning a tin drum that had something in it, and it was just full, crawling with maggots. It's the sort of thing you just came across in the countryside, especially in the 80s when I was growing up. You don't see them as well. I haven't seen a maggot in a while. I'm not saying it's a time I'm looking back towards. You know, I'm not nostalgic for the time when you could uncover you could find a rotting corpse of a bird. But this, yeah, so this is great. So and what's clever about it, the fact that it's, you know, set in the mines. Look, there they are. I mean, that's grim. And so great, because they're real as well. It's pretty great. But what I like about it is that it's old industry, mining, meeting new industry, you know, chemical, you know, global chemicals. So it's there's something more going on there than just the plot. You know, it's something about the old and the new clashing. Our traditional methods of doing things. This is a brilliant cliffhanger. That's a lovely bit of film. So that's much better than it would have been had they had to do it in the studio. I always think that initial shot of the maggots a bit weird, because they don't look particularly mobile. They look like they're just sort of coming down on a you know, that they're immobile and coming down on a sea of green. But these three here, absolutely terrific. And then this close up, where you can see its teeth as well. As far as I'm aware, maggots don't have teeth, but I don't care. Doctor Who's maggots do, and they're great. Quite why the titles are upside down, I've no idea. It's odd that they decided to invert them for this story only, but I wonder if that was an accident or deliberate. I think that's a terrific cliffhanger. I think that shot of that maggot is absolutely magnificent, and might well be my bit of the story. I do like Stevens's sort of forlorn response to Boss's instructions that they must hypnotize Fel. I do like the relationship between those characters. You really do feel that they know each other outside of this adventure, Elgin and Fel and all of that. I buy that relationship. I do like the scrap that the Doctor does, and the way that Hinks goes, Gonna have a go. Terrific. I like that. I like sort of Hinks's laid back insolence. I like the clash between new technology and old industry, and that's, you know, that's something that provides more than drama, because that's something that is an argument in all countries, really, about, you know, when traditional working methods are replaced by fancy, you know, industry of the future. What is the place for humanity? What are the side effects? What are the consequences? That is all, you know, big and important within this story. And I love that. That gives you something to think about. That means that the drama exists beyond, you know, the dramatic situations that the characters are presented with. I like all of the actors, but I think I'm going to go, and it is the one with the maggots. I mean, that's what this story is called. It's Doctor Who and the giant fly. My God, I'm sure we're used to when I first had the books, I just looked at the covers. I'm sure I thought of this for a while as Doctor Who and the giant fly until I learnt to read properly. Certainly, Talon's Wang Chiang was Doctor Who and the giant rat. you know, we pared it down to the essentials. Sure, Doctor and the Giant Fly, that's just come from some recess. But no, it is the one with the maggots, and I think that those that shot of those three, and then that final close-up and the teeth, they're beautifully made. They've got the right texture. They're a very convincing prop. They move very convincingly. And the way that, which doesn't happen in some scenes in this story, the way that they are augmented into everything around them, the way that they fit into everything around them, is seamless on this. Even though we're cutting from the Doctor and Joe on videotape to the maggots on film, because of the lighting of the video and because of the way that it's done, it all actually knits together very nicely, and it feels like it's all part of the same sequence. So I'm going to go with those maggots, those three maggots, particularly that final shot and that cliffhanger. Now, my friend Ruben Herfindahl from across the pond is going to give me the United States official view of episode 2 of The Green Death. And he is going to choose his favourite thing about episode 2, which is...
So, favourite things out of episode 2. Well, I'm just going to go straight with my favourite things out of the entire series. Michael E. Bryan. What an amazing director. His shots throughout the entire thing, I keep falling back to all the shots with Bessie driving around, even tripping later on into episode 6 with that final shot. The Green Death wouldn't be the Green Death if anyone else had directed it. This is the pinnacle of directing for John Pertwee's era, and God bless him, he's amazing. I had the honor of meeting him a few years ago, and yeah, it just doesn't get any better than this. Amazing.
Oh, I think that's lovely. It's always nice to hear somebody giving a shout out to a director, and Michael is a lovely, lovely guy. And you know, a stalwart director, but how early in his career was this? That's the amazing thing. Colony in Space was his first gig, and this isn't that long afterwards. He's still amazing. He's in his 80s now, but he's still sailing. He's, you know, he could be 20 years younger, actually, Michael. And he's a really interesting guy. He's very keen. He's very game. He's very engaging. He'll always reply to an email and is happy to chat. So I'm always very grateful to hear from Michael, and he loves his actors. You know, we talk a lot about actors who he used a lot, like Maurice Perry, who was one of his favourite, who's in Colony in Space, of course. Richard Beale he used a lot, and he does direct this. He's not as gritty. I think I warm particularly to the gritty directors. I think Camfield and Michael Ferguson, This would be very different directed by either of those people, but I think Michael Bryant is the right fit for this. And I think he creates those, the worlds, very beautifully. And I think he makes them all distinct. So you have, you know, the world of the Nut Touch, then you have the world of the miners, and you have the world of the, you know, the global chemicals in the office. And I also like the way that, you know, he sort of seamlessly gets the regulars involved in this new environment that is for this story only. And, you know, he works really hard with the film work is gorgeous, and he's ambitious with that. And the effects work, it doesn't all work, let's be honest, it doesn't all work. And I think that's what made me step back from The Green Death a bit when I was an angry teenager, is that I thought, well, I can't show this to my friends. But again, it's one of those ones that watching now, when all things become a bit more equal, I don't care now. I don't give monkeys what anybody else thinks. I know how good this was for its time, but you know, you show anybody now of my age, not just Doctor Who, if you show them The Sandbaggers or The Power Game or even some Dennis Potter plays, they would, you know, they would balk at how it looks, because we've been trained to watch television in different ways and strive for, in inverted commas, realism. It's not realistic, and in 20 years time we'll look as pony now because we've got wise to the way that we fictionalize everything, from sort of speech patterns to the way people talk or whatever. We become wise to it, we become inured to it as viewers, and it looks fictional to us because that's how fiction looks, and so then we strive for it to be done in different ways. That's just the nature of things, and so Doctor Who now, you only have to show a not we, as it were, the Caves of Androzani and the Twin Dilemma. We know that they're poles apart in terms of production values and skill, but they look the same. They would look the same to somebody that isn't trained in the art of deciphering brilliance from archive television. So, I'm less touchy about the things that could be seen as the downfall of this, and you either go, well, I accept them for what they are, and I, you know, viewers at the time, they knew that was CSO fringing, and that was how they, you know, they made things happen in a studio that they couldn't otherwise do, and you got on with it. In the same way that when you see somebody get stabbed in a play on stage, you don't see the sword go through that person and blood and guts spill out on the floor because it's artificial, but you invest in it and you go with it, and you choose or you don't. And as I've said before on these, you win if you go with it. You don't win if you choose not to. You haven't outwitted anybody. So, yeah, I think Michael Bryant does a lovely, lovely job. And it's a really ambitious production, what they've decided to do with it. Lots of location, underground mines, you know, lots of different styles of location. So, you know, hats off to John Burroughs, the designer, who creates lots of different environments. I'm loving this episode, all that stuff in the mines and the lighting down in the mines. Kudos to them for that. But Michael Bryant as director is an excellent choice. But I chose my maggots, and I'm happy to wave my maggots about in front of you. I'm glad that it causes the cliffhanger to scream. Thank you so much for listening to Happy Times and Places, which is presented by me, Toby Haydoke, and my special guest, Ruben Herfindahl. I'm grateful to Ruben and to the patrons who make these podcasts possible, and they include John Molyneux, David Brody, Runa Brutig Olsen, Mark Trevor Owen, Russell Parker, Andy Parkinson, James Parsons, Phil Pasco, Richard Patey, Ken Patterson, John Pettigrew, Kitty Placati, Liam Price, Ian Radford, Peter Reed, Paula Reynolds, Sean Reynolds, Murray Robertson, Alex Rowan, Ronin, or Tom, Darren Rule, John Rumfitt, Gavin Rymill, Tom Selinsky, Matt Sawyer, Nick Salmond, Edward Salt, Samuel, don't have a surname for you, Samuel, Frank Shales, Christopher Sharp, John Sheehan, Gavin Skinner, Dale Smith, David Smith, Trevor Smith, Richard Smith, Andrew Sneddon, David Spencer, Matthew Speddings, Joey Stephen, David Spofforth, Chris Stokes, Mark Swan, and Dr. Gary Thomas. The music is by Dave Gates, the artwork by Dylan Patterson. Would you like your name mentioned on the end of the credits of one of Toby Haydock's Time Travels podcasts? Well, that is one of the many bonuses you get from becoming a patron. That is at patreon.com/Toby Haydock, where for as little as £3 a month, you get all sorts of goodies. You will have heard this podcast 6 months ago when it was hot off the press, almost live. And you would also have got, the day after that, a picture of my dog doing something jolly. And also monthly AMAs, Ask Me Anythings, exclusive content, lots of other bits and bobs. At least 3 audio or video releases per week, and just, you know, a nice place to hang out and indulge in geeky things. And that's all at patreon.com/Toby Haydock. £3 a month is the lowest tier. There is stuff there to lure you up the tiers, but frankly, it's a sort of pay what you can. Most all of the important stuff is at the lowest tier, and you can get 10% off any tier if you sign up for a whole year in one go. And then I've got you. If you don't want to commit to even a monthly thing, though, you can just give the odd donation every now and again if the mood takes your fancy. And that's at ko-fi.com/Toby Haydock. It's the way that we self-employed artists fund ourselves these days as the squeeze gets ever tighter and the desire for content increases. So it's free at the point of contact on iTunes and Podbean and Spotify and all of those. But if you want it early and you want other bits and bobs, then Ko-fi or Patreon. But, you know, I know times are tight. Times are extremely tight. Everyone's feeling the pinch. So what costs you nothing is to go to iTunes in particular and give these 5 stars and perhaps a few lines of review to let the customers know what they're in for. And that really helps with the algorithms and enables these to get noticed. And of course, the nice feedback is very much appreciated. Even though I've read If by Rudyard Kipling, and I agree with all of the sentiments, I ignore the bit about treating nice comments the same as bad ones. I just want the nice ones. So if you could do that, you will be very, as I said, well, yeah, that bit's dated, hasn't it? You will be a man, my son, because it's a universal creed, really, if, isn't it? About just being decent. But because of the time that it was written, it's addressed very much from a man to his son. And so it's very sort of gendered. And I think there's nothing wrong with acknowledging that, but also saying it doesn't take away from the sentiment therein. Wonderful poem, If, which I've just managed to get bogged down in 20th century worries whilst explaining and celebrating. But if you could give, despite that, you could give my algorithms a tweak, I will be very ruddy grateful. Thank you very much. There's also much fun to be had on social media. I'm at Toby Haydock on Twitter. These podcasts have their own feed, at Haydock Podcasts. I'm also on Instagram, at Toby.Haydock, where I'm learning how to do videos, and I think doing quite a decent job. And I have a Facebook page as well. So all of those are good. One of the lovely things about having a patron is that they are a kind of unpaid, in fact, they're paying for the privilege, sort of copy editors, proof editors, because, for example, with my latest Too Much Information, I'd made a mistake. It's amazing how you can do such a deep dive and then make actually quite a simple mistake that was very much hiding in plain sight. And, you know, somebody will go, I think you find that wasn't quite right. You go, oh, no, brilliant, thanks, which means that I get it in a sort of safe space, if I like, because I think anyone who's a patron and, trusts me to be working hard and is inclined to be forgiving in a way that, you know, that people listening on iTunes and things like that, you quite often get... I got it last week. Got somebody saying, there haven't been any releases this week. Has something gone wrong? No, I might just be having a week off because I'm tired. And they're free. You get 2 a week. And I just haven't put any up this week. I mean, it was something had gone wrong. It was a mistake. But it was the expectation that slightly made me go, Yeah, there's quite a lot of content flying out of here. But anyway, they meant it nicely. It's just it amuses me that how sort of quickly we've got used to sort of going, are you not releasing something this week? As if say, well, it's free. You don't have to release anything ever. Whereas it's not on Patreon, and I take keeping up with the Patreon releases quite seriously, because I think in this day and age, the fact that anyone gives any amount of money to something that they don't have to, and to, you know, somebody that is giving out stuff that is generally free, even though it's a bit later, and that is, you know, disposable, ephemeral, you know, podcasty, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that people choose to sort of give patronage to the arts is essentially what it is. Although, yes, I know this isn't particularly artistic, but you know what I mean. It's a creative endeavor that people choose without any compunction to subsidize, and I really, really appreciate that. So yes, I the fact that actually the people on Patreon also sort of are the first port of call to go, you know, that's a mistake, or I couldn't, quite often, you know, there'll be an editing mistake, or I'll have, because, you know, it's amazing how much stuff can slip through, because it's just me, you know, I don't have an editorial team, I don't have an editor, I don't have anybody, so apart from the patrons who are paying to be there, who go, yeah, you haven't uploaded the file or something like that. Anyway, loads of people listen to the Green Death episode one. And I'd muted the music in order to record the titles, because what I tend to do is have the music as a mute track so that I can time it, and then I unmute it, and there we go. I release it into the wilds. But I forgot to unmute the music, so the first version of the Green Death episode one went to patrons with no theme whatsoever. I was just yelling the names into the blackness, and nobody said anything. Now, I'm sure they must have noticed. Or maybe people just fast, you know, just jump. No, because I know one of the people, Neil O, yes, Neil O, who was mentioned, heard his name, but obviously, maybe I'm just scary and they didn't want to say, Toby, you haven't done the music. Or maybe it was the Emperor's new music. Maybe that's what it was. They thought, well, I don't want to sound silly and think I haven't heard the music when everybody could hear the music. Who knows? But anyway, a lot of people, it goes to show that, you know, you can spend a lot of time on stuff. Not only do you not notice, other people either don't notice or just don't care enough that it doesn't really matter. We don't say anything. But anyway, thanks for sparing my blushes. But also, if you are a patron and you do hear a mistake, tell me. That was a microphone clog. I'm going to keep that in just to prove I'm not a robot. But you're under no obligation to do so, of course. You're paying for the privilege of having this stuff early and for all the other access that you get. I don't expect you to act as my unpaid scientific or at least podcasting advisors. But it did amuse me that, it's been up all weekend as I record this bit and about to put up episode two. Nobody said a word. I'm hoping this one is totally free of mistakes, but it probably isn't. I've probably spent the whole thing referring to the Green Death as the Mask of Mandragora. Those are the sorts of mistakes that slip through. I tell you something about what an extra had for breakfast, but the really obvious stuff your brain isn't on the lookout for. So, yes, I hope you enjoyed this this Matt Smith Doctor Who story, the Blue Life. There we go. Joe Grant's first story, of course.